Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
You're kidnapping people and forcing them to disappear from the streets. Two of them are people who disappeared from the streets after leaving my office, two young people. And so there's been pressure mounting across the country that these people should be released. And even if anybody have done a mistake or violated the law, due process of the law should take place.
A Kenyan senator calls for a Commonwealth judicial inquiry into allegations of abductions of critics of the administration.
Angola has played an important role, and from where I observe from, they seem to have done everything that they can to bring the two governments together to try and resolve this rather long-standing issue.
An analyst expresses doubt about efforts to resolve tensions between the government in Kigali and Kinshasa.
Put up this review of the whole salary structure so that it reflects the current reality. It reflects the difficulties that this country is going through and the fact that, you know, something needs to be done to be able to improve the lives of the last ordinary people.
And a prominent cleric calls on Liberian President Joseph Boakai to review the salaries of senior public officials in the new year. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A Kenyan senator is calling for a Commonwealth judiciary inquiry to investigate alleged abductions and disappearances of activists and critics of the administration. Okiya Omtatah also says he expects the security institutions to respect a recent court ruling that ordered the release of all abducted citizens within 7 days. The senator is receiving medical treatment following his arrest by police during recent protests. He warns there could be more demonstrations if the detained citizens are not released. Senator Okiya Omtatah tells me that an external judicial investigation can find out those involved in the alleged disappearances of Kenyans.
An unfortunate thing has been happening in the country since we had the July 25th storming over the parliament of Kenya by young people who are dissatisfied with the nature of the way the country is being governed. And so at the end of the day, they began arresting and kidnapping people and forcing them to disappear from the streets. Two of them are people who disappeared from the streets after leaving my office, two young people. And so there's been pressure mounting across the country that these people should be released. And even if anybody have done a mistake or violated the law, due process of the law should take place. Because over 80 people are now missing. So, and that's why I went ahead and filed a habeas corpus application to compel the police to release them and other state organs. And the court has granted them 7 days within which to release these people. Some have been held for more than 4 or 5 months, others for days. And so it's a demand we're making across the country that we cannot allow our country to go back to lawlessness.
You believe next week coming, the government would have to respond to the court order after the ultimatum of a week?
Yes, we expect that by the time we get to Wednesday, Tuesday next week, it should be very clear. The people should have been released. Otherwise, we're going to have a lockdown in Nairobi.
Why do you say there will be a lockdown? Are you not threatening the country's territorial integrity and peace?
No. It's part of enforcing the Constitution. We have a Bill of Rights, which under Article 29 guarantees one, the safety of the individual and freedom of movement. Article 49, which says for what you should do with arrested people is to arraign them in court within 24 hours or to let them go. But this thing is that people are being snatched off the street and disappeared. They don't leave interest. You can't get interest where they are. Some have been released, tell you about horrifying stories of how they were tortured and told that should they repeat doing what they were doing, they would be killed, stuff like that. So I don't see any threat in what I've said, because it's what we are going to do. It's not a threat. It's what we are going to do.
What do you mean by a lockdown? What do you mean by that?
We want to get the masses out, masses of civilians to come out and join in the call for the people to be set free. So there'll be a situation whereby Nairobi and other major urban centers will have massive demonstrations to demand that the young people have been kidnapped are set free. Because the kidnapping has not only targeted these people, our Kenyans. We have had cases whereby people were kidnapped, Ugandans were kidnapped in Kenya and produced in court in Uganda.
Some people are suggesting that perhaps in addition to the court order, an investigation should be carried out to find out those who are allegedly abducting Kenyan citizens. Where do you stand on that?
I think not. Maybe a proper word would be a judicial inquiry, an inquiry under a judge. And the judge from, we would want a judge from the Commonwealth, because the Commonwealth judges have got same jurisdiction in Kenya. We would want a judges from the Commonwealth, members of the Commonwealth, be it India, be it wherever, Australia, be it Britain and stuff. We will not be open to a judicial inquiry. An investigation by the very police will not yield much. There will not be an opportunity for them to confuse us further. But before even going to an inquest, the people have to be produced, the bodies have to be produced, because they were taken off the streets by security forces, and there's no reason why the security forces cannot be responsible enough to release these youngsters.
Okiya Omtata is a Kenyan senator. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. President William Ruto has consistently said his government is not involved in the alleged abductions, but has said the allegations will be investigated. In a New Year's speech on Tuesday, Ruto said, quote, "It cannot be denied that there have been instances of excessive and extrajudicial actions by members of the security services." He did not elaborate on what those actions could be. He also went on to say that freedom has its limits and that public safety and order must always supersede the desire for unchecked liberty. A political analyst is expressing doubt about the effectiveness of efforts to resolve tensions between the government of Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Goloba Mutebi says the political and diplomatic gap between the two neighboring countries appears to be too wide for a resolution of the tensions. This, he says, despite the mediation efforts of Angola to find a solution to the dispute between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. For analysis of the Angolan mediation efforts, I reach Goloba Mutebi in the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
Clearly, Angola has played an important role. And from where I observe from, they seem to have done everything that they can to bring the two governments together to try and resolve this rather long-standing issue.
But some people are suggesting that sometimes rhetoric from both sides have not helped in the effort to try to resolve the tension between them. What is your take on that?
I think it's not just merely rhetoric. I think what has happened or what is happening is that the two governments are still quite far apart in terms of defining what the core of the problem is, of the root of the problem is. As you may be aware, Rwanda has been arguing all along that this crisis cannot be resolved until the root cause of the insecurity in the east of the DRC is addressed. And as far as they are concerned, and as far as I know, they argue the root cause is the presence in the DRC of insurgent groups that threaten security or stability in neighboring states. And specifically for Rwanda, it is the FDLR and its designs on destabilizing Rwanda. So the M23, as far as we know, has its roots in this crisis. Now, the argument is until FDLR is dealt with and it stops causing insecurity and pushing these people out of the DRC, there can't be a lasting solution to the issue. Now, the DRC government, of course, comes up with its own response, which says that, look, M23 doesn't exist. M23 is the RDF, in other words, the Rwanda Defense Force, and that they are in Congo entirely for the purposes of stealing Congo's wealth and bringing it to Rwanda, and that's what Rwanda uses to develop itself. They contest the idea that M23 is made up of Congolese citizens, that these are Rwandans who are masquerading as Congolese, and therefore the government of the DRC is not prepared to recognize them and the arguments they are making about wanting their rights to be protected.
Do you think that there's a political will and commitment from both governments to resolve this problem once and for all, looking at the gap that exists now, despite even the efforts of Angola, mandated or backed by the African Union, to try to resolve this issue?
From where I'm sitting in Rwanda, I would argue that the political will on Rwanda's part is there, because for them, their argument is very simple, that for this problem to be addressed, as I pointed out earlier, the root cause must be addressed, and that is the insecurity in the DRC and the space that insurgent groups in the DRC have to engage in activities that threaten the security of neighboring countries. So for Rwanda, it seems like the argument is very simple. Deal with FDLR and the consequences of their activities in the DRC, and then you're moving very close to addressing Rwanda's concerns. And you're moving close to addressing the concerns of M23. And once you have done that, then you deprive M23 of any excuse to wage war against the DRC government. And if you want to argue that M23 are Rwandans, then once you've dealt with the what they consider to be the core problem, then you have deprived them of the excuse to wage war. So if we stop there and then look on the other side of the DRC.
So looking forward, what are your expectations? Do you expect the issues, the core issues between the two governments to be resolved?
I wouldn't say that I expect them to be resolved. I wish they could be resolved. But it seems as if there are other intervening factors that are making this even more difficult. And one of them is the interference of Western powers. The other thing is that now there are so many other militia groups that are involved in this. There is the embeddedness of the FDLR in the Congolese army, as claimed by Rwandans and other observers, and that also makes it very difficult for this issue to be resolved. But hopefully, sense will prevail and we shall see a resolution in the coming year. But I wouldn't say I'm very optimistic.
Goloba Mutebi is a political analyst. He spoke with me from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. A leading member of the governing Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM, has rejected criticism that the party's decision to endorse the re-election bid of incumbent President Paul Biya is a disservice to the country and its people. Professor Elvis Ngole, the coordinator of academia for the ruling CPDM, says the majority of the electorate has confidence in Biya's leadership. This after local media quoted Samuel Kleda, the Archbishop of Douala, as saying the long-term president re-election effort as unrealistic. It comes after opposition and civil society groups criticized the ruling party for endorsing the 92-year-old president's plan to seek re-election in the coming general election. Biya, they say, is too old and may not have the energy that the office of the president demands to administer the affairs of the country. But Professor Elvis Ngole tells me that the criticisms appear to be from those who are afraid of losing the election to the incumbent president.
Well, my response is that we should give credit where credit is due. We should give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and not mix Caesar with the Pope. I think that the Archbishop of Douala is a prominent religious leader, and we respect him for that. But I don't think that in matters of politics or in the domain of Caesar, which is the domain of politics, that a citizen of a republic would necessarily have to go to a religious leader in order to make a political choice.
Some people are suggesting that they have seen the president in public. People have even speculated about his health condition. Problem is, some people are saying that they look at the man who does not really have the energy of a youth. The Cameroonian people are full, majority of them are youth, and that they need somebody who is youthful, who has energy to administer the affairs of the country. You think their suggestion is wrong?
Not that I think that is wrong, but everybody has a right to their opinion. I mean, look at the statistics. Let's go, let us be scientific enough, because we live in the age of science. In Cameroon, there are 7.8 million voters that are registered. And of these 7.8 million registered voters as of 2024, the youths amount to a total 2.6 million. It means the rest, the majority, the vast majority, who are registered are not the youths. We know that there are also the other social statistics whereby more than 65% of the population of the country is made up of youths. That is a population, but look, in a republic, and particularly in a democracy, we go by competitive elections. And elections are based on one man, one vote, and guided by or within the framework of the constitution and electoral laws.
Talking about one man, one vote, some people suggest that even the CPDM is not fair. The political terrain is not level, and that CPDM uses a powerful incumbency to literally shut down the rest, not making it competitive enough for Cameroonians to choose the best person they think can administer the affairs of the country, and that the CPDM makes it impossible for a fair play during the elections, and that is why they think the elections will not be fair in the first place. Your response to that?
No, those who make that case are those who are already approaching it from a defeatist standpoint. I mean, what has the CPDM got to do with implementing the laws? We all know under the constitution and under the electoral laws in Cameroon, there is an organization, an institution that is charged under the constitution, under the law, to manage elections. That institution is called ELECAM. There is a constitutional council that is there to proclaim the elections and to ensure the regularity of the laws. So I think that the CPDM respects this law. The CPDM respects the constitution. The CPDM respects the electoral laws, and everyone else should do so. But those who are competitors, meaning the other actors, be they civil society actors or actors from other political parties, have to also be under our constitution, have to be in a position to respect those same institutions and those same laws. So instead of spending energies accusing the CPDM is not the one that organizes the elections. President Biya has the right, which he does, under the law, under the constitution, and it is, as you know, I mean, there are legitimate voices in Cameroon which want that he should be the candidate. And in the party that he is the head, the statutes, meaning Article 27 of the statute of the party, says he is the candidate. So it's not that he's not conditional. He is.
Professor Elvis Ngole Ngole is the coordinator of academia for the ruling CPDM. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. In Ghana, the presidential candidate of the Opposition Convention People's Party, or CPP, is calling on citizens to unite and work together for a better country. Nana Akosua-Frimpomaa also says the outcome of the recent general election is a clear message that Ghanaians would hold politicians accountable for the impact their decisions have on their lives. The Electoral Commission declared former President John Dramani Mahama the winner of the presidential contest, defeating incumbent Vice President Mahamudu Bawumia. Frimpomaa came in at a distant fourth after garnering 12,671 votes, representing 0.11% of the total cast. In a new year, the only female presidential candidate in the December 7th elections also called on Ghanaians to be hopeful and collectively work toward growth and development. For more on her new year message, I reach Nana Akosua-Frimpomaa.
Looking at the elections that just passed, it is very clear that Ghanaians have arrived at a time where we have really deepened the democracy, and we have shown that we would use the power of the thumb to really, really speak our minds. And for that reason, it is important that we come together, just as we came together now to do what we did, to be able to now focus on what is important. It is my prayer that the president-elect will see the immense power that has been given him and how we use that power to ensure that Ghana becomes the beacon that it is and was before.
Regarding your call on Ghanaians to work harder to build a better Ghana, what do you mean by that?
All of us have a part to play, especially where we are. There's so much there's a lot of exploitation, a lot of... We still live in a society that there's so much difference between the haves and have-nots, and it is important that we collectively do to make sure that we are able to have equity so that Ghanaians would have equal share to whatever that we are going to build for this country. And that's what I'm asking. We must work harder. Otherwise, there's too much poverty. There's too much lack in the system. Yes, you might see a lot of properties coming up, but the living standards, the human beings, their life and their living standards are going down. And it is important that we really work hard to get Ghana back to its level that it's supposed to be.
Nana Frimpoma, some people are suggesting that your call on citizens to approach the year with renewed hope, focusing on collective growth and development, is neither here nor there, because you politicians are to blame for the difficulty, the economic challenges they are facing now, that instead of coming up with an agenda to improve the living conditions of the people, irrespective of the political party that comes to power, you decide to chart your own course once given power, and that politicians are to blame for the country's problems. What do you say to that?
To some extent, I would say yes. But again, the Ghanaian electorate has shown clearly that the politicians will be held responsible and accountable for their actions. And for that reason, it is important that politicians remember that. And that is why we must all work together, because we cannot sit down for politicians as well to do everything. We must hold them accountable. And to do that, every Ghanaian, whether you are the market woman, you are the teacher, a doctor, you do your part. And that is why I'm calling for the hard work.
The election is over, but some people are blaming the CPP, that the party seemed to be retrogressing, and that is why Ghana appears to be becoming a two-party state.
I mean, clearly, it is on the surface, that is what one should say, but then looking at where we are now, looking at what our father said, he says, forward ever, backwards never. We need to be looking at where are we going from here. Clearly, the CPP had 12,000. We did almost 100%. From a very difficult past. The CPP has a history. Not that I'm justifying where we are, but there was a very conscious effort to ensure that the CPP collapses. Everybody, people were criminalized, and when the power came back, we merged with the NDC, and all our positions and were taken over by the NDC. And so today, trying to get CPP up has not been easy, but we have the formula. And it is the formula that I have been preaching for the past 4 years that will not get its footing, that currently every member of the party now has seen the call for reorganization and the call to go back to the grassroots. So I can tell you that looking forward 2025, starting today and starting now, the CPP is poised to ensure that we attract the youth. I called on the youth to come in and take over. They did not get it. Now they understand.
Nana Akosua-Frimpoma is the presidential candidate of Ghana's Opposition Convention People's Party, or CPP. She spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. A prominent Liberian cleric is calling on President Joseph Boakai to review the salaries of the most senior public officials in this new year, which he says are too high. Bishop Kotu Brown is the senior pastor of the New Water in the Desert Assembly and a former president of the Liberia Council of Churches. He says it will be in the interest of the government to review the salary structure to ensure it reflects the reality on the ground. His remarks come after calls by the public for a review of the salaries of senior public officials. Bishop Kotu Brown tells me that Liberians want the president to take bold and radical decisions to address some of the challenges facing the country.
Actually, it's been like a running battle. You know, it's something that has been difficult, especially lately, to go away. Given the economic, you know, situation of history, Liberians are concerned that some of the salaries are very huge. There's a need to do something about it. And I think that as we go into the new year, that it will be in the interest of the country, it will be in the interest of the whole governing process, that the president does something about it, is able to put up this review of the whole salary structure so that it reflects the current reality, it reflects the difficulties that this country is going through, and the fact that, you know, something needs to be done to be able to improve the lives of the last ordinary people.
But Bishop, some people are suggesting that this has been the salary structure for quite some time now. So why are Liberians saying the salaries have to be reviewed currently?
Because I think many Liberians hope that the country will make progress for the better, but the country continues to be challenged. And so Liberians believe that there is a need for some radical move, radical decision-making to be able to, you know, address some of the current challenges that we face. There are economic challenges, there are social challenges. You know, the young people are in the street. Liberia's population is more than 60% young people, and a good number of the young people are in the street. They're in big shift centers, they're in, you know, marshland, they're in different areas. We need to, as a country, to address these challenges, and I think it makes sense, you know, to be able to look at the addressing of these challenges from all angles, you know, of our national life.
There have also been instances of criticisms that some of these government appointees are prioritizing personal interest over the welfare of the Liberian people. Some of their supporters are saying it is not a fair criticism when they are just doing their job to ensure that the president's vision is actualized, for which reason he was voted for.
My advice to the president of Liberia is to look through his government. I believe that you could have three, you know, kinds of people: the Esos, the Judases. The Esos are those who they don't regard the rule of law. They want to do their own things. They don't care about, about values. You know, and those kinds of people need to be excused, you know, government. But there are those who are the journalists. They don't take their responsibility very seriously unless they are pressed, you know, to do that. And there's a need that we deal with, that the president going forward in this new year will deal with the journalists who are in his government, put them overboard, put them, you know, outside, so that maybe they can use that time to reflect and maybe make a comeback. Then they are the Judases. They are the Judases, the most maybe terrible ones, the ones who they can do anything. They can even sell their master to be able to just, you know, make ends meet. And until you address these three kinds of people who, you know, are most time almost in every government, and they contribute to the stalling of the national development, you know, program, it will be difficult for us to make the kind of progress that we want to make.
What are your expectations of the government led by President Boakai this year?
That the government will give Liberians hope, that Liberia can work, that Liberia is able to make achievements, make improvement, that Liberia is able to overcome our challenges. We expect that in the new year, Peter, that our government will be a little bit more engaged on trying to address bread and butter issues. There are some efforts, you know, here, there, and yonder, but there's still the majority of Liberians who are struggling, who find it difficult to make ends meet. There's still the majority of Liberians who believe that the government needs to do more, and I concur with them. So in the coming year, I think that it's on the government to reflect, see what it does in the last 1 year, and to, you know, put out what we call a review agenda, you know, for 2025. So that some of the areas where they were weak, they're able to improve in those areas, and they're able to bring in some new ideas, some new people, you know, so that, you know, Liberia can make some progress in 2025.
Bishop Kotu Brown is the senior pastor of the New Water in the Desert Assembly and a former president of the Liberia Council of Churches. He spoke with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. In Malawi, the leader of the main opposition in parliament is calling for change in the new year, saying last year was full of, quote, darkness and a leadership void. George Chaponda, a founding member of the main opposition Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, says Malawians should demand accountability from the administration over the inquiry into the death of former Vice President Saulos Chilima, who died in a plane crash last year. His remarks came during his annual public reflection of the year 2024. But critics say his statements are just another attempt to reduce the popularity of the government, especially when a majority of Malawians say it has made significant strides in service delivery and ending hunger. For more on his expectations for the new year, opposition parliamentary leader George Chaponda tells me that Malawians deserve better.
In my reflection, I consider the events that have shaped this year and to draw lessons that will guide us forward. And this year, as I've said, has been marked by tragic loss, suffering, and a consistent failure of leadership at every level of government. It is a year we will not soon forget, but one from which we must derive the strength to demand better for ourselves and our leaders in 2025. Why am I saying this?
I was about to ask you, why are you saying this?
The loss of Vice President Saulos Chilima and 8 other Malawians indeed is a tragic incident which occurred and left us a deep scar on our nation. However, the Commission of Inquiry instituted to investigate the incident has been a pass. Rather than bringing justice or answers to the families of the victims and to the Malawian people, it has only served to deepen the sense of betrayal. We cannot and will not accept a hollow exercise that ignores the truth and dismisses the legitimate questions that arise from such a loss. The people of Malawi deserve transparency and accountability.
What about the issue of human rights?
Yes, the issue of human rights was paramount. The MCP, they showed their true colors in terms of human rights. We have seen MCP youth in masks armed with pangas to suppress innocent Malawians exercising their right to peaceful demonstration.
Are you not playing politics here by accusing the MCP supporters?
No. I'm saying we had innocent demonstrators who were demonstrating as provided in the constitution, their constitutional right. And immediately they started demonstrating, we had seen those people whom I'm saying, MCP people, youth, in masks armed with pangas. Those are the ones I'm talking about. And this reminded us of the time when the MCP was ruling for 31 years under the iron rule of the Dr. Hastings Kamuzu Banda.
You also called on Malawians to demand change in 2025. What do you mean by that, especially when the recent poll by Afrobarometer
showed
economic progress have been made significantly?
There has been no economic progress which has been there. If there's anything which I might say is that the economy is in a state of stagnation. Our people are struggling to meet their most basic needs, and our health system is on the brink of collapse. What should have been a lifeline to struggling farmers has been mired in inefficiency, corruption, and poor planning. Many Malawians who rely on this has been left without the support they desperately need.
Talking about the collapse of the health system or the health sector, wouldn't you put the blame on successive governments who failed to actually build up the health sector? It shouldn't be the blame of the MCP alone, some of your critics say. Your response to that?
My response is that it is the right of a Malawian to receive a proper health facility. And I do not subscribe to say, because that government did that, then we have to do the same. This is a government that promised in August 2020, that they will ensure that the health system will be proper in this country. And because of the promise, Malawians, that they will have 3 meals a day, they will give them employment, 1 million jobs. They promised so many to Malawians. But unfortunately, we are now in a situation where if people go to the hospital, they have to buy medicine on their own. This is a reality, and nobody can dismiss it. So I am saying in 2024, they better do something because they have not lived up to their promise.
George Chaponda is the leader of the main opposition Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, in Parliament. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. Malawi news media quoted the Minister of Information, Moses Kunkunyu, saying that going into an election year, it is common campaign strategy for the opposition to, quote, avoid acknowledging positive strides being made all the time. Among other things, Kunkunyu noted that Malawi had gone through hardships that now mean it qualifies for the International Monetary Fund's extended credit facility and budget support. In Zambia, the opposition Tonse Alliance is calling on its supporters to defend themselves against violence by partisans of the governing United Party for National Development, or UPND. This after accusing the police of failing to act when its spokesperson, Sean Tembo, was recently attacked at a police station. It adds that the failure of the police to arrest those involved in the attack is yet another demonstration that they are not willing to equally enforce the law. The police deny the accusation, saying they enforce the law irrespective of the offender's societal status. The opposition alliance is also calling on other opposition groups to field single candidates in both parliamentary and presidential future polls. Sean Tembo tells me that Zambians expect the police to be firm and carry out its mandate fairly, irrespective of the political association of those who break the law.
For us as Tonse Alliance, I think we had to arrive at this decision on the basis that the Zambia police have not been helping in protecting us from the violence, the continued violence of the ruling UPND party. As you noticed in Kawangwa, we were viciously attacked. We were stabbed. Myself in particular, I had to run from the polling stations where I had gone to inspect the election monitors and polling agents on election day. I was chased from those polling stations in Rushiwa and the Rianga wards of Kawangwa Central Constituency by about 5 motor vehicles. And there is evidence to that. There are videos to that effect. We had to drive all the way on a rim because our front tire had a tire burst. We drove straight to Kawangwa Central Police Station, and we went behind the police inquiry's desk there. But the UPND cadres got inside the police station. They stabbed me on the hand inside the police station.
Why wouldn't the Tonse Alliance engage the police and express your concerns about what you think is the lack of protection or enforcement of the rule of law, rather than take the law into your own hands, which will create chaos in the country?
Self-defense is a right which is enshrined in our constitution. So you are not correct when you say we would be taking the law in our own hands. If we were going to be the instigators of violence, then you would say we would be taking the law in our own hands. But for us to protect ourselves, to defend ourselves, that is a right which is enshrined in the Constitution. Coming to your question, we have always engaged the police on this matter. This is not the first time in Kawangwa that we are being brutalized. We opened dockets and nothing was done up to now by non-UPND cadres. Our state institutions here in Zambia have totally collapsed, Peter. So maybe you are looking at things from the point of view of another country where there is a rule of law, where there is a due process.
But they have denied that. They have denied this accusation that they enforce the law irrespective of the political affiliations.
Well, Peter, did you expect them to admit that they are siding with the UPND? Maybe as you are engaging them, asking them questions, you should have asked them to say, this assault, the stabbing of President Sean Tembo happened inside Kawangwa Central Police Station. How many people did you arrest? Because he was stabbed inside the police station. You should have asked them that. And they would have had no answer for you.
You are also calling on other opposition political parties to, you know, form an alliance or perhaps, you know, side with a common candidate to avoid splitting of votes. What does that mean?
When you look at the results of the Kawangwa Central by-election, which took place about 2 weeks ago, you're going to realize that had we united as opposition, we would have won that seat. And our appeal is that, you know, the other political parties do not necessarily need to join the Tonse Alliance per se for now, but we can begin to collaborate and work together in these upcoming by-elections where we give each other a chance and say, okay, fine, you have a stronger candidate. Can you field your candidate in this by-election? And then another election, we say, okay, fine, we have a stronger candidate. Can we field the candidate in this election to the exclusion of everybody else? So you need to have a starting point. Once you have that working relationship, then you can build on that, and then maybe the issue of them coming to join the Tonse Alliance can arise at a later time. But for now, all we are appealing to in terms of our federal opposition is that let's have a working relationship. Let us begin to work together, even though we are not yet in a single alliance, but that should not prevent us from working together.
Sean Tembo is the spokesperson for Zambia's opposition Tonse Alliance. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In September, the U.S. military completed its withdrawal from Niger, where it had two bases that help partners in the Sahel counter terrorism. The pullout came after members of Niger's military staged a coup in 2023. The U.S. military says the withdrawal has had a major impact on its efforts to fight terrorism in the region. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more.
With the U.S. military now out of Niger, defense officials say their presence in West Africa has dropped from about 1,000 troops at this time last year to fewer than 300 today. U.S. Major General Kenneth Ekman led the withdrawal of U.S. forces, who were helping counter violent extremist organizations, or VEOs, in the Sahel.
If there was one country that was most important on our ability to address Sahelian VEO problems, or the Sahelian VEO challenge, it was Niger. It is a strategic setback with regards to how each of us pursues our security objectives in the region.
Military analyst Bill Raggio says the already dire terrorism in West Africa is worsening.
The jihadists have been on the march. In some countries, it's stunning. For instance, Burkina Faso. It's admitted that about 40% of the country is under control of Al-Qaeda's branch there.
He says that without a major base to host troops and surveillance drones, U.S. and French counter-terror missions in West Africa are in bad shape. Without the Western support that existed before the junta ousted the democratically elected government, Niger has failed to hold back a rising terrorist tide. The Nigerian military says terror attacks earlier in December killed at least 39 people, including children, near the border with Burkina Faso.
In Niger, violent extremist attacks have become more lethal. That's a fact since the coup on 26 July 2023. They've got fewer resources and fewer partners.
But officials say the withdrawal doesn't mean the U.S. military is giving up on West Africa. Instead, it's resetting its efforts.
This is the nascent stages of our reset.
General Michael Langley, the head of U.S. Africa Command, told VOA in October he aims to build a new footprint to help fight the region's growing terror threat.
We pulled out of Niger, but we are engaging with coastal West Africa countries because if we look at the what direction is metastasized on the northern regions of Cote d'Ivoire, of Ghana, and Togo and Benin.
Ekman says that requires a different approach.
If our presence in Niger allowed us to go inside out relative to the Sahelian-based VEO threat, we now have to revert to going outside in. Countries like Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Benin, Chad, our access to them and the degree to which they want to partner with us will influence how we go outside in.
And General Langley says negotiations to work with those governments will take time.
We're still in stages of defining what that host government at their higher levels of what they do want from us to be able to complete that solution set to effectively account terrorism.
As deliberations continue, more and more terrorists are threatening the very governments whom analysts say have pushed away the countries that might be able to help them. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
President-elect Donald Trump has made immigration a key focus of his 2024 presidential campaign. His incoming administration is planning stricter enforcement. VOA's immigration correspondent Aline Barros explained what these policies might mean.
In his presidential campaign, Donald Trump promised stricter border measures, including greater detention and deportation of undocumented immigrants.
We're going to end up with the largest deportation in American history. We have no choice. Have no choice. Right? Have no choice. We have no choice because that's not sustainable by any country.
Possible Trump plans include expanded detention facilities and a return to the Remain in Mexico policy, requiring migrants to stay in Mexico during U.S. immigration proceedings. Trump's pick for border czar, Tom Holman, says tougher enforcement will focus on improving public safety and national security.
The heels of the biggest illegal immigration crisis we've ever seen in this nation, there has to be a massive deportation operation.
Some immigration experts say mass deportations weaken public safety by discouraging immigrants from reporting crimes. David Beer is the director of immigration studies at the Cato Institute.
Immigrants are more likely than the average U.S.-born person to report crimes to the police. But studies have repeatedly shown that when indiscriminate enforcement increases in an area, that reduces that already high rate of crime reporting or higher rate of crime reporting among immigrants.
If migrants do not have criminal records, Democratic and Republican administrations have generally released them while they await immigration hearings. That may end with the incoming administration considering mandatory detention. Immigration attorney David Leopold.
If I were a lawful permanent resident, a green card holder, I'd be sure to have my green card on my person now.
Trump officials argue that these measures will deter criminals, but Beer found that was not what happened last time.
Mass deportation is going to deprioritize serious offenders. When the Trump administration came in last time, they rescinded all the requirements to focus on serious offenders, felons first, and as a result, not surprisingly, ICE doubled the number of arrests of non-criminals.
Meanwhile, he says the number of criminals found attempting to cross the border tripled. Trump says he will act on immigration on day one of his presidency, January 20th. Aline Barros, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Come from the wind to la, ah, 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 ah. Tu
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mogville Yabaru, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, he who dines with vultures must be ready to eat rotten meat. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.